Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. In the 20th century, a new movement from the Far East captured the Western mind. Since then, the intersection of Christianity and martial arts has generated both conflict and harmony. In between, there remains many gray areas. In my new book, Jesus in the Dojo, I combine timeless theology with modern catechesis to provide a clearer path of reconciliation between the Christian faith and the practice of martial arts. You can find my book, Jesus in the Dojo, available now at most booksellers.
Life is a quest for logic and reason. It is a quest to find balance between science and faith. Life is a quest for knowledge and understanding. But most importantly, it's a quest for personal discovery. Whatever your quest, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. Welcome to Quest.
Hi, Lucy. Welcome back to the Quest podcast.
Hi, it's great to be back. I'm excited to talk with you.
Yeah, well, this is the beginning of season 6, so I'm on my way to 100 episodes. So you're in the season where that's going to happen.
Nice. Congrats. That's so exciting.
I don't have records like you, but I'm pretty happy I'm getting to 100. So, But I wanted to have you back because you are really extraordinary. And I loved our last interview. And it was actually one of my most popular episodes of the last season. So I wanted to have you back because you have new stories to share, new experiences, some crazy stuff I'm going to save for a moment from now when we get into this. But I want to refresh my memory. So when we talked last time, you were planning to, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you planning to climb a different mountain and then there was a reason you couldn't and then you chose K2 instead? Was that what it was?
Yeah, I've been trying to do the Explorers Grand Slam, which Everest was a part of. And so I was planning on doing the tallest mountain in Papua New Guinea, which is the tallest mountain in Oceania as well. And that one's called Karstens Pyramid. So I was planning on doing that, but it's been closed for years. And unfortunately, it continued to be closed due to tribal warfare. So there's like a big civil war going on in that country. So I wasn't able to do that. And then I was hoping to go to the North Pole. But then with the Russia-Ukraine war, that one was also closed. So just kind of a lot of logistical problems around doing the Explorers Grand Slam right now. So that's when I decided I'll go to K2 instead.
Now, is K2 is a tougher climb than the other two you just mentioned, right? Like what you were going to do before?
Oh, much tougher. Yeah, it's said to be the hardest mountain actually in the world to climb. It's tougher than Everest, tougher than pretty much any mountain there is.
So you did this over the summer. So tell me about that experience, because I watched anything I could watch that was on your Instagram, all your feeds. And the first thing I noticed was it seemed like it took forever for you to actually get to the mountain. And it was like constantly like hiking and hiking and hiking. And I was like, when's the climb going to begin? Talk to me about the preparation that went into this and, you know, what it was like just to get to the base of this before you started to climb, because the climb itself is its own crazy part of the story, but give me the setup for this.
Yeah. Going to base camp on K2 is definitely not an easy feat. It was a lot harder than the base camp trek to Everest. It took 8 days in total. So we were trekking for 8 days, but it was pretty, it was very deserty. It was a desert climate. So that made it really difficult just with trying to conserve water, and then just being in that hot environment for so long was really challenging. And it was a lot longer days, a lot harder days for sure than the Everest base camp trek. So yeah, it was definitely a challenge just to get to the base camp. But then at base camp, I was there for a long time before I got to actually go and do the actual climb.
And just kind of like walk me through what that's like just to get to the base of the mountain. Are we talking like, are you hiking like 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day? How many miles is that? Like what was that like? What were the details of that?
It varies a lot, but it's around like our longest day was 13 miles and our shortest day was probably around 6 or 7 miles. So it was you know, maybe like a I think the shortest we hiked was like a 3 or 4 hour day. This one day that was really, you know, nice and short. And then our longest day was around 10 hours.
Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible. I think one of the, you know, the biggest stories we heard this year was about the death that was on the mountain, and you were there when this happened. So tell me about the climb itself and how that was for you. And then when you, you know, you heard about this, this death on the mountain, let's hear that.
Yeah. K2, the climb was a crazy experience. It was the longest I'd ever been on a mountain. I was on the mountain for 40 days. So most of that time I was stuck at base camp. It was a really horrible weather season for K2. And normally one of the hardest parts about that mountain is the high winds and bad weather. But this year particularly was really tough. So I did one rotation up to camp one and back, but we didn't go higher than that just because of the weather. It was like a short window. So, and there's three camps, and then the some people use four, and then the summit. So we were just going to use three, and then the summit. So we went up to camp one, back down, and going to camp one is super challenging. It's harder than most days on Everest. Like one of the hardest climbing days I've ever had. It was very difficult to get up, and we actually went to camp one two different times to acclimatize, because we went up and then it took so long for the rope fixing team to set the ropes because of the weather that we had to go another time to acclimatize because our bodies weren't acclimatized anymore to go on the summit push. So it was a lot of just kind of like on the fly things. No one really knew what was going to happen. But then finally we got the signal to go. Everyone was like, okay, like let's go for the summit. And it was the last weather window of the year. So there had been no weather windows before that. The rope fixing team hadn't even fixed to the summit. So to even climb a mountain, like K2 or like Everest, there's a team that it's called the rope fixing team that puts ropes all the way to the summit of the mountain. And that's what allows you to like go up and down those ropes to actually climb the mountain. So before you even start to climb, like those ropes have to be up there. So that's what was like kind of holding everyone back, was that it was just such bad weather, the rope fixing team couldn't even go up. But finally we decided, you know, we were just going to follow one day behind the rope fixing team, and everyone, literally like 150 people, all tried to summit basically the same day, all on the same summit timetable. So yeah, we went up camp one, going to camp two, camp three, and then that's when going up to camp four going up to the summit from camp three that night was when the accident happened, which is a Pakistani porter that was with the rope fixing team actually fell, and he somehow it's still kind of unclear what happened. We don't know if like he broke a bone or something, but he couldn't walk down by himself, and he was hanging upside down with his stomach exposed just to the elements, and it was freezing at that time of night. He didn't have proper clothing on, so his stomach was just exposed, and you know, he was in really bad shape. And the kind of scandal part of it was that people actually walked past him, like stepped over him while he was dying to get to the summit. So that's made big waves and ripples in the mountaineering world since then.
I followed some of the stories. You know, you were in a lot of stories about your trek to get to the top, but I did read a lot of news stories out there, and it seemed like there was a lot of conflicting information about what happened to Muhammad Hassan and what exactly the injury was. You know, some people had said he fell into like a crevasse, and then other people said, you know, part of some ice had broken off and hit him. And like, there was I never really got the straight story maybe on what happened. And like you were saying about people, you know, stepping over him, one of the stories I read was about a climber who was trying to make the fastest climb to the top. And that, you know, the arrogance of her to, you know, disregard someone's safety to, you know, achieve a record. And it's really, you're right, it was very scandalous. And I didn't know this kind of thing existed in the mountain climbing world. And then I, you know, I do recognize, like, I imagine a rescue for a guy like that would be very, very difficult, right?
Yes, definitely. It was, he was in probably the most dangerous part of the mountain called the bottleneck. And to have a rescue would have been near impossible. But, you know, people say, like, you still have to try. You know, someone's dying, at least effort, you know, should be made. That's kind of been like the main kind of like point, is that, you know, it's not that, you know, could it have happened or not? Could it have been successful? It's, you know, it should have happened regardless. Yeah. It's what people are saying.
I remember you posted a photo that was just a bottleneck of people. There must have been 100 people on the mountain in front of you. That was insane. And I believe it was like the middle of the night, right? Was it like, you know, you were climbing like really late.
Yeah. You always start like summit day. We started at midnight, and that was actually later than anyone else started. Our plan was kind of to start later. People start at 5 PM, 6 PM, 7 PM, 8, like all throughout the night, and start climbing to summit the next morning.
Right. Right. And then I guess, you know, you never saw the guy that was injured. Did you? Did you ever get that close?
No, I didn't. Actually, the photo that I took of those, like that line of people, was basically the farthest I went. After that photo, we were hit by a big avalanche caused by everyone standing and waiting. Because what happened, that the photo was kind of showing, was that everyone was just standing still, like no one was moving, because of the guy, the Muhammad Hassan, who had fallen. No one knew what to do, like how to help him. So everyone was just backed up in a very dangerous part of the mountain. The Great Serac is right above that part of the mountain. And, you know, Seracs can fall at any time and kill people. So that's kind of, you know, that's what prompted people to step over him and go past, because they were concerned for their own safety, which is definitely a valid concern in that part of the mountain. So we turned around because of there's a big big avalanche that we were in. And we just decided, with the amount of people and the snow conditions as they were, there was a lot of snow and about 150 people trying to summit that day. So we knew, like, even before we went on summit day, we had me and the two people I was with, my Sherpa and one other person, we had a talk, and we were like, we're going to go, but we're, you know, if there's anything sketchy, like, this is a very dangerous situation. So we have to be okay with turning around when it's, you know, when it's not safe enough to continue. So that's what we did.
And when you heard about Muhammad, like, is that, I mean, that's got like be like a grapevine thing, right? Like everyone's just talking about it down the mountain, and you're hearing someone's injured. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why there's so many like different perspectives, and it's so unclear what happened to him. Because, I mean, it's hard to explain the amount of just confusion that goes on in the mountains. Like, people are all communicating through walkie-talkies, and they, like, the people on the mountain are communicating back to base camp, and then base camp is communicating back to people on, like, people climbing. So it's, like, this two-way thing, and there's so many people telling base camp different things, and base camp's telling other people different things, and then just things get spread around up there, up and down the climbing line.
The grapevine, so right?
Yeah, it's such a grapevine. It's like, you know, it's like a gossip circle almost, you know? It's you really can't trust whatever you hear until the story comes out from the people who actually were there and saw it. So later when I was back at camp, I was, you know, the people I was at base camp with were in my climbing company were the people who were right there, like that were with him when the accident happened. So I did get that part of the story. But when we were climbing up, we had just heard, someone had fallen in a crevasse and was injured, and no one could get him out or knew what to do. So that's what we heard when we were climbing up, but which ended up not being the case. He never fell in a crevasse. But,
yeah. What time was it? Do you remember the exact time when you decided you had to turn back? What was that decision like?
It was around 3 a.m. So we had only been climbing for about 3 hours, and we were making really good time. We were almost going too fast, because our plan was to leave later so that everyone would leave earlier than us and you know, pack the trail for us, and that, you know, there would be less avalanche danger and we wouldn't be near people. So there would, you know, that would also make it so there's less avalanche danger, because it's usually the people climbing in front of you that kind of start those avalanches. Right. So we want to be kind of behind everyone, the big herd of people. But by the time, you know, 2.5 hours, we had basically, when I took that photo, we basically caught up to everyone in that line. And that was right around Camp 4, which no one actually used that year, but right below the Great Sirac, where Camp 4 normally would be, is when we kind of, you know, caught up to everyone, and that happened. So it was, yeah, that was kind of like the bad part, is that we caught up to everyone, and that's what caused the avalanches, the people ahead of us.
And what was that like, that decision to turn back? Is that bittersweet? Were you sad? Is it, how do you feel about that?
It's difficult. And on this mountain, I definitely handled it better than I'd, you know, handled past mountains where I've had to turn around early. I was definitely at peace, honestly, with the decision, because, just going up to that point, I knew I was super proud of the effort I'd put in, of everything I'd done. And I almost like had this feeling where like I knew I could summit. It was only, we were hours away from the summit, and I was feeling really, really good. So I almost had kind of this peace of mind where it's like, you know, I really believe I can do this, but I just decided that it wasn't safe enough. And honestly, it wasn't safe enough for the people around us either, because the more people that are up there, the more you put yourself and the people around you at risk. So I didn't really want to be part of that process of making it riskier for those around me. So I felt good about the decision to turn around. And also, it was just such a beautiful morning, too. We had been in clouds, like, the whole, from Camp 1 to Camp 2 to Camp 3, just so cloudy. And then finally, the clouds had broken. It was just this beautiful, gorgeous morning. And that, I was just like, I was really enjoying the scenery, and just feeling pretty good. But then later, you know, at base camp, it hits you. You're like, man, I didn't get to the summit. You know, I really wanted to do that. And that definitely hits you. But it didn't really hit me like in the moment we were turning around. It kind of hit me later. But I still, like, even now, like, I'm still at peace with my decision. I'm glad that I made that decision.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you know, after you got back, you posted, some things about, you were really, you know, rethinking things about your experience mountaineering. And I was wondering what that meant. They were fairly cryptic posts. And I thought, just, you know, I couldn't help but wonder, you know, is Lucy not wanting to climb anymore? You know, how does she think about the mountain differently? And I really wanted to hear that in this interview, kind of what you meant by that.
Oh no, I love climbing more than ever. I'll never stop climbing. It's made me like rethink a lot about kind of my place in the mountains as like a client. Like, up to this point, I've done a lot of like mountaineering since I was 7, but I've never, you know, taken any courses or got any medical training, avalanche training, things like that, you know, would make me more of an expert in the mountains, rather than like more of a client. So, that's what I've been kind of rethinking is, you know, I recently took like a wilderness first responder, medical course that has, you know, I think would help me so much, even in this situation on K2, like, would make me just more confident in that situation, know what's going on and maybe be able to help. So that's really what I've been kind of changing. Cause I always, you know, the guide companies, it's like they market it as, you know, you're safe. Like, we got you. Anything that happens, like, well, it's under control. But really, like, seeing that on K2, I'm like, it isn't all the time, you know? Sometimes you have to be responsible for yourself and the people around you. So that's kind of the switch that I've had. And honestly, I am considering doing some, like, guiding classes and things like that. Or not classes, but getting some guiding, like, assistant guiding experience, doing, like, a part-time thing this next upcoming summer, fitting it in between school. And yeah, just things like that to really become more of like a leader in the mountains, not just, you know, following people up.
My producing partner was at the Knowles Institute, the National Outdoor Leadership School.
Nice.
And he did a lot of different programs that were there. And I was involved with those for a while. shooting some video and things like that. And it's the survival training that you get there is like really amazing. Like I had no idea what the, I mean, you could drop these people anywhere and they would know how to survive. It's like really pretty incredible what they could, do. It's really interesting. But I saw that, you know, that you took that class. I was going to bring that up a little later in the episode that you, you now, have your wilderness training in, which is cool. I want to say a couple more things about K2 before we move on from it. Did I hear you were collecting snow samples while you were there?
Yes.
What were you doing?
Yeah,
what was that about?
So I was working with the scientist named Dr. Pena, Dr. Ulana, and she's a doctor, or she's a researcher at Colorado, the university there in Boulder. And I was working with her to collect snow samples from the glacier at different elevations so that she can measure the black carbon that's present in the glacier. And the black carbon is what basically contributes to the melt of the glacier because, you know, it's very like dark, it attracts the sun, and that's what really causes the glacier to melt a lot faster than it normally would. And black carbon comes from, you know, basic carbon emissions like your car, you know, factories, things like that. So, you know, if you're cooking something, anything, it basically creates that black carbon. So she's studying how much of it is up there, how exactly that, like, it contributes to the melting glaciers, and then how we can, you know, prevent it and try to reverse those effects. So that's what I was doing, is just helping to collect that data.
Wow. So when will Lucy return to K2? I'm assuming you want to try it again, right?
Yeah, I definitely do at some point. This next summer, I definitely won't, just because I really want to focus on that more of the gynae aspect. And that'd probably be somewhere in the U.S. or, you know, Canada, somewhere more local. But I definitely do want to go back. And a lot of that depends on funding, because K2 is a very expensive mountain. So I definitely, you know, it depends when funding comes in, things like that, sponsorships. But I would, you know, one of these upcoming summers, hopefully in the next few years, I would love to get back to it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was reading a story the other day about Mount Fuji. I made some notes about it. I wanted to bring it up because there's a lot of problems right now with Japan's highest peak as a victim of overtourism. And I want to talk about overtourism, because what I saw, the pictures you posted, the stuff I saw, was like, this is madness. Like, I had no idea so many people were going to these mountains and doing this. Like, I didn't realize this was such a popular sport and so many people, and especially at the cost. Like, I saw how much money you were raising and I was like, this is nuts that people can do this. And so I have some stats here, and it says for Mount Fuji, it says in 2012, more than 2.3 million people visited the 2,400 meter high fifth stage, with a smaller number continuing to the 10th and highest stage. By 2019, that number had more than doubled to just over 5 million. And in July of this year, when the annual climbing season began, about 65,000 hikers reached the summit, an increase of 17% from 2019. This is crazy, these numbers. Have you been experiencing this yourself? Like, I guess, I assume so on K2.
Definitely. And I think one of the main things is the 14 peaks that are over 8,000 meters. Those have become super popular, which K2 is one of them, and Everest as well. So I think, especially with like the 14 Peaks documentary and just like the media, more the media around mountaineering, these kind of 14 Peaks have been really like popularized, and, you know, all over as well. Like Mount Fuji is an example of how this is happening all over. But yeah, like I've really witnessed the change in mountaineering and I haven't been around mountaineering for that long, especially not in the, you know, Nepal and in the Himalayas. But from what I've, you know, kind of read and seen, it seems like it's becoming, a very, very popular for almost, you know, anyone that's an athlete that's in shape. And that's causing a lot of problems, because sometimes, you know, sometimes people that aren't experienced can make it to the top if your trip goes smoothly. But if, you know, a lot of times it doesn't go smoothly, and if you have no prior mountaineering experience, you have you no idea what to do. You're completely in the hands of your guide, or, you know, your Sherpa. And they're amazingly strong, but sometimes you have to be responsible for yourself. Sometimes they can't help. So it's definitely an issue. And, you know, also with like the pollution on the mountains that goes with the so many people being on it.
And the, I wanted the to ask about that.
All,
yeah.
All of that.
The trash.
Yeah.
I figured that many humans up there would probably be wrecking things.
Yeah. And it's a lot of like the media portrays it as more than it is. Like there's not like piles of trash on Everest or K2. I've never seen something like that, but there definitely is trash up there. You know, I mean, there's people climbing up and down the mountains. There's going to be trash around, you know, so it's definitely an issue for sure that there needs to be more regulations. And the U.S. has regulations like that, you know. In national parks, you have to pack in and pack out everything, even, you know, even your poop, you pack in and pack out. So there's just not those same regulations over there, you know, yet, but hopefully there will be eventually, and definitely more regulations also on, you know, who is qualified to be a client in the mountains. But the guide companies, I mean, it's completely changed the economies over there for the better. Like these very poor towns are now, you know, seeing much more tourism, and it's really helping them. So there is definitely a positive side to it as well. Where it's lifting people out of poverty. So that's, and you know, I don't blame them for marketing it to everyone they can, because, you know, that's their source of income.
You know, for me, I always looked at people that wanted to climb these amazingly tall mountains as these like elite adventurers, the kind of people that would want to take a balloon around the world, you know, or go up in, you know, for space tourism. Like I just, to me, it always seemed like a very elite thing to do. But then I see all of those people in the mountain. I think it almost, this all, to me, almost looks like a touristy thing to do if you can afford it. And then I can't help but wonder, like with, in the case of Muhammad Hassan, like it doesn't, I don't know how experienced he was, but it doesn't seem like he was too well prepared, at least attire wise, for what he was doing, which makes me think, well, he probably should have never been on the mountain to begin with. Is there some truth to that, you think?
Yeah, I mean, not on the mountain at all, but definitely not, you know, above base camp to where things get really technical without any training. Like, yeah, from what I've heard and read, you know, it sounds like, you know, he really didn't have any mountaineering training. That was one of his first seasons on K2 above base camp, I think his first one. And yeah, he didn't have the proper gear, like equipment or training to be up that high. And, you know, there's not a system in Pakistan for porters to get training at all. You literally just thrown in, you know, to being a porter. And then eventually, if you're strong, you become a high altitude porter above base camp. And your training is being on K2. Like you just learn season to season. But, you know, sometimes you don't make it, you know, as Muhammad Hassan, you don't make it past your first season because, you know, you don't have that training to be able to protect yourself. So it's, yeah, that's a huge problem. But there's just not enough infrastructure. There's so much poverty over there. No one's going to fund, you know, a school or something like that to actually train the porters to do that.
And probably not much regulation really for these types of things.
Essentially none. Yeah.
I want to know what's the stupidest thing you've ever seen someone do on a mountain?
Let me think.
You must have seen someone incredibly inexperienced or wearing something incredibly dumb or taking a selfie at absolutely the wrong place that they shouldn't be doing it at. Have you seen anything, or have you been around like just people that really knew what they were doing and you didn't see anything like that? But I'm curious.
More recently, I've definitely been around, you know, people that I've known know what they're doing, and I haven't seen like a ton of stupid things. But I mean, like one of the more serious things that I've seen that was definitely a very bad decision was when I was on Denali my first time. There was a man who clearly had very bad pulmonary edema, which is like fluid in your lungs due to altitude. Mm-hmm. And that's like a very serious condition where you need to go back down. And like everyone could hear it. You could hear him just like coughing and like the fluid in his lungs. And he just kept going up and up. And actually it cost him his life. He died wow. on that mountain. But yeah, like just summit fever type of things, like where you do step over someone that's dying, you know, type of things like that, that, you know, you get so focused on your goal. And, you know, some people, you train for years, you invest so much money and time into these goals. Like, yeah, I understand that, you know, you want to accomplish them. But yeah, some people definitely get that. I mean, everyone gets that tunnel vision, that trying to go for your goal, just to what extent, you know, you're willing to go to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you're back in the U.S. now. You're taking a break from college, right? You're off for this semester, but you're going back at the yes. beginning of the year. What's yes. next for you? I know you're talking about wanting to like level up your schooling and getting some training on some things like this, but what are the next big goals for you? If you had to pick another mountain to climb now, what's next? What's 18 months or 2 years from now look like for you?
Well, I'm really getting into rock climbing, especially like when I look into like guiding opportunities. If you really want to be a serious guide, like you have to have that rock climbing aspect. So, mm-hmm. and I've wanted to rock climb for years. I've just never had the time. You know, I've always been in high school, college. Whenever there's a break, I go to a mountain, you know, more focused on high altitude and glacier mountaineering rather than like rock climbing. It's never really been a part of what I do. So it's been really exciting to get more into rock climbing these past, you know, honestly few weeks. I've just been going to the indoor gyms around here, but mm-hmm. In this time off right now, I'm getting to go to Joshua Tree for a few days, Yosemite. So I'm definitely going to look for some bouldering and rock climbing around those places for sure. So that's really exciting. Just kind of like recently. And I'm also hoping to do an avalanche course in my time off from school in like November before I go back in January. So just getting more like skills like that and more safety things. And then, you know, as I said, maybe guiding, assistant guiding next summer would be amazing. Somewhere like Mount Rainier, somewhere, you know, in the U.S. on a glacier mountain would be pretty awesome. And then hopefully just, you know, getting prepared for the next high mountain. And I still really am hoping to do the Explorers Grand Slam. You know, as soon as those mountains open up, I am going to be there. I'm really excited for that. But that's just, you know, something I can't control with these wars going on. But hopefully they end soon and I'm able to do that. But I'm also, another kind of aspect is that I love the climate research I've done on K2. Has really inspired me to kind of get more into that. So I'm applying for a lot of grants and scholarships to be able to, you know, maybe go to Antarctica or the North Pole and do more climate research there. So I'm really looking forward to hopefully those adventures if those scholarships work out. So nothing like set planned, but a lot of possibilities for the future that I'm really excited about.
Yeah. I don't think I ever asked you this in the previous interview, but do you see kind of, if you were able to leap forward in your life a little bit, you know, post college, do you see yourself maybe having a career surrounding this outdoor life, or do you see yourself in a completely different type of setting? What is your degree? What do you kind of degree are you getting?
My degree is public policy. So I'm hoping to go into water policy. I'm really passionate about the water and sanitation crisis. You know, a big focus of the brand I've made is, you know, to fundraise for water projects in different countries. So that's always been like, I've always been really focused on that. That's always been something that's, you know, I'll wait for this. it's always been something that's been really kind of central to who I am and something I love to do. And, but I have been like, I definitely want to be in the outdoors my whole life. And just with the expense, I've been thinking recently that, you know, it's much better to be a guide than a client if it's something you're going to be doing for your whole life. So I definitely see, you know, being in the outdoors my whole life. And I've been considering more of that like career in the outdoors. But if I could, you know, if I could do a combination, you know, have my own brand that like leads outdoor like guiding activities, but something I can do like part-time while I'm still doing the water, you know, water policy and all that. I'm not sure. We'll see. I have too many passions that I really love to do, but
you have some time.
Yeah.
You have some time.
Figuring it out.
Well, Lucy, it's been a pleasure to have you back on. Tell everyone again how they can find you out there on social media and the interwebs and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I have a website. It's lucyclimbs.com. And that has, you know, all my information on it, links to my my Instagram and all of that. But Instagram is definitely what I'm most active on social media wise. And that's What's Next Lucy. Facebook, my Facebook's linked to that. So Facebook as well, same What's Next Lucy. So yeah, that's pretty much the platforms that I'm active on. Sometimes I post a TikTok here or there. And it's the same What's Next Lucy username. Sure. Yep.
Well, let's do this again after your next mountain.
Sounds good. I love it.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Hi everybody, I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cult Following is a podcast that studies the personalities and common traits of cult leaders and their followers. Get the real story behind these infamous and oftentimes tragic cults from a new perspective, through exhaustive research and from interviews with people that were there. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel DePlantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith, and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.